guardian of the universe. Simply to get the forces of evil. The powers of this man.
Hulk was too great.
Complete tall buildings. Up in the sky.
Is it a bird?
Is it a plane?
A mailman by day.
Cities. Guardian by night.
Defending the citizens of New York.
For centuries, the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. World's mightiest mortal.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of mere earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it, Kick-Ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
You don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess they didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
And get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Kick-Ass, released April 16th, 2010. Budget was about $30 million. Box office take of $96 million. And this was directed by Matthew Vaughn. Well, this is not the first time we've covered a Matthew Vaughn film. Although, that previous show we did is lost to the sands of time.
You know, I was going to say...
It's been three.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the past month, no matter what we have to say about it, is at least competent filmmaking. And for that, I am going to applaud.
Well, this kind of bucks the trend from the last couple of movies, because this was the first one we've done that was not branded as utter garbage by the general consensus. Got a theatrical release. Has notable names in it, which some of the previous films, in fact, the last two, did not whatsoever. But it's technically also not a quote-unquote Marvel release, because the original graphic novel, which we'll talk about, was based under one of Marvel's sub-branches. I believe it's called... God, I'm blanking on the name.
Icon?
Yeah, I think it's Icon. But it's nevertheless still a Marvel release. Does deal with superheroes, so for that reason, I mean, we've made exceptions for far grayer areas, so let's let's just keep this in. So before we get to our theatrical experiences, have either of you read this graphic novel or were aware of it by the time this movie was coming out?
I was aware of it. I was aware of it being done. The issue with me, and it looked interesting, it looked intriguing. I spoil a little bit here. I can't stand John Romita Jr. JRJR is one of my least favorite artists. I just can't stand his style as much as I love his father. And Mark Miller is so hit and miss for me that as much as I heard good things, I steered clear of this comic completely. And as to this day, as the comic guy, I still haven't got around to it.
Funny. because this is one of the comics in this series that I am familiar with, because this movie came out in 2010, and we're going to talk about theatrical experiences later, but the year after, I was curious. I went to Comic-Con the year after, in 2011, and there was a stand with Kick-Ass, because the movie had come out, like I said, in 2010, and I actually did buy that comic, because I was curious as to what it was. I was fucking shocked, boys. Shocked by the shit that was in that book. There are things in that book that I don't know how this movie came out the way it did, with shit like, oh, let's have the girlfriend suspect the guy's cheating, so she's gonna go and have oral sex with his friends behind his back. There's some crazy shit going on in that book that is just unlikable as hell. So I did read this book all the way through, and then by the time I was done, I was like, I didn't care. I'll talk about the movie here in a bit, but the book gets 3 out of 10 for me. I didn't like it at all.
So as a point of clarification, it's Image is the comic subgroup that published it. So I have never read the graphic novel because Mark Millar and I have a very complicated relationship. I first came to know Mark Millar when he wrote the Civil War comic, which we will talk about extensively in about 15 years. I was not crazy about the comic, but he's done some things that I really liked. He wrote Old Man Logan, which I thought was really good. But I will give Mark Millar this. Much like Steven Spielberg, he struggles to stick the landing. And he also has that in common with Stephen King. And I remember going to see a little movie called Wanted, which was the first adaptation. And I love that comic. And the movie changes the premise and makes it far less interesting than how it's presented in the original source material. So I was, when I heard this was from the same author, I thought they were doing the same thing, where they were taking a premise and just drastically altering it to suit a movie. Now, even though I haven't read it, I understand this is certainly much closer than the Wanted counterparts are, but I knew next to nothing going in.
Funny when you talk about Wanted, because to me, I watched the movie first, really, really enjoyed it, and then everybody told me that the graphic novel is comics or like nothing next to it. So I never bothered reading those.
You want to keep your image of how good it is in your head, huh? I've done that. Yes.
I went the opposite direction. Yeah.
Well, spoiler alert, the comic book is not about assassins, which is what the movie is. The comic is all about the main guy is the son of a supervillain. So that's much more in line with this type of superhero film than the movie represents. And I may be a gay man, but seeing Angelina anorexic Jolie waving a gun just does nothing for me. You know, of course nobody could shoot her. All she has to do is turn sideways and nobody will realize. So at the very least, this is much more of a superhero movie. And really, let's talk about when this came out. This is now a post-Iron Man and Dark Knight world. Mm-hmm. As the Joker said in that movie, we have changed things. And the superhero genre, I think as we know it, dramatically upped their game after those two movies came out. And this sort of does something, and I can't speak on the comic, but it sort of presents something like Christopher Nolan did with his Batman movies. What if superheroes existed in quote-unquote the real world? Now, granted, this is not 100% depiction of the real world. There are some exaggerations. But as far as we know, this is a world where people do not possess superpowers. So it is tackling something that was different from the norm, albeit we were still not yet in the... There was really no talk in 2010 of superhero fatigue. I don't really think that picked up until years later. If anything, this was kind of in the middle of the golden age, like from Iron Man to, I would say,
the Avengers, right?
I would probably go till what, Endgame?
Okay.
That's kind of the height, because it wasn't until after Endgame that people really started to turn on not just Marvel, but the genre in general. But I think because it didn't have a brand associated with it. They didn't slap the Marvel logo on this. They didn't, no. You know, it's not based on a pre-existing character. So I think that's why it didn't. I mean, look, tripling your budget is nothing to scoff at, especially for a movie of this ilk. I mean, it's got one really notable star at the time, someone who would become a bigger star. But let's talk about the director, actually, because this is a man who we will talk about extensively in a couple weeks again by taking another Millar adaptation. Matthew Vaughn, if you recall, was going to direct X-Men 3. He was locked in, all set, ready to go, and then his wife got pregnant, and he said, hey, can we give me some time to deal with real life? And Fox said, no, the movie's coming out in 2006 with or without you, and he said no, and he got booted off the project.
Sounds like Fox at that time, doesn't it, Garrett?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, before that, he had a little movie called Layer Cake, which, honestly, boys, and I know I'm going to get a lot of shit for saying this, but there was like an onslaught of these guys coming in, like Guy Ritchie, Matthew Vaughn, Troy Duffy, I guess, you know, I'll mention him, that came in, and they were like these invasion guys who were coming in from Europe and doing these Tarantino knockoffs that I didn't like. And Matthew Vaughn was one of those guys. Never seen Layer Cake, but coming in, I had zero expectation for this movie before I even knew what it was, because I'm like, oh, here's another one of these guys coming in and trying to take a something that is very American and trying to do it his own way, and I didn't really respond to that.
So I take it you didn't like Stardust either.
Oh, God. Oh, if we ever do that movie, I have. Yeah, I couldn't stand that film. Ooh.
There's a lot of places we could fit that in. I think we might have to.
We might have to. You're right.
Ooh. Especially because it's got both Superman and Daredevil in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the cast and crew alone might necessitate a discussion.
But if you remember, also, Matthew Vaughn was going to do Thor at one point. This was before Marvel sort of went into business for themselves. So it would have kind of just been its own thing, kind of like how X-Men was, would not have necessarily been tied to a bigger thing. But if you see Stardust, I mean, looking at it visually, I'm like, okay, I could see why they would want him for Thor, especially with the production design and things like that. But knowing what we know now, I think it kind of worked out for the best. And he did get to do an X-Men movie year after this, so it's not like he was totally removed from superheroes. But yeah, as far as Layer Cake goes, Garrett, to your point, that was during the period where everybody was trying to be the next Tarantino.
Yep.
And all the, you know, especially with the non-linear type of storytelling, which both Layer Cake and those early Guy Ritchie movies did. The difference is, I think Layer Cake, it's not that it showed Daniel Craig could be James Bond, because I don't think that was the case. But it showed that Daniel Craig could carry a movie. And that movie's also got a really interesting cast beyond it.
Yeah, and everybody tried telling me that Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels was great. And, oh God, I didn't like that one either. And I'll be honest, and I said this during Casino Royale when we did that, I never gave Layer Cake a chance because I just was not into that genre at that time.
So how did Vaughn get attached to this? Well, the rights to this comic book series, the first volume, which makes up this movie, that was sold before the comic was even published, which I guess shows the confidence they had in it, or they were so desperate to buy the rights for all the superhero movies that they would snatch any property that they could find. And Mark Millar had actually, he was the one who pitched it to Matthew Vaughn. He said, you know, I want you to do this. He sent him some of the materials, like some of the panels and a base outline, and they wrote the script right after the premiere of Stardust. It turns out they met each other at that premiere. I don't know why Mark Millar would be there.
Yeah, why was he there?
That's just a very odd coincidence.
Yeah. I mean, some of those people, once you get in with some people, it's networking.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking of networking, they then brought in Jay Goldman, who has been Matthew Vaughn's right-hand screenwriter for a lot of his movies. You know, she did both Kingsman films. She was a co-writer on First Class. So this went through a couple people's hands. And as far as I heard, nothing major as far as difficulties. The only thing was that they went to Sony for distribution, but Sony turned it down because of the violence. They thought it was too graphic. And they also said, and this is ridiculous, which we'll talk about with the movie, they wanted to make Hit Girl into an adult.
Yeah, I've read that.
And Goldman was quoted as saying that would have been more offensive because as a teenager, she would have been sexualized. That's where their first instinct would have been. So Vaughn's like, well, what do we do? Because we don't have a studio behind it. And R-rated superhero movies, let's remember Dark Knight's PG-13, although that should have gotten an R. I still don't understand how it didn't. But you look at things like Punisher Warzone did not make any money. In fact, no Punisher movie has ever made money.
I was going to say, has any Punisher movie made money?
Which is what, you know, this is pre-Deadpool, so that's kind of, I think, showed the R rating shouldn't be a deterrent for success. But I think the one that really kind of set a bad precedent in a lot of ways was Watchmen came out the year before this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, you know, that's recontextualizing superheroes altogether.
If we ever do that one, and I don't see any way that we won't, that movie took a comic book and tried making an on-screen comic instead of taking a comic book and making a movie out of it. And that was something that if you did that with this material would just go really, really poorly. And some argue that Watchmen went really poorly as well.
And like I said, you know, the big thing is you don't have a big star to sell this on. And let's be honest, the comic was not especially well known. It was very much an underground. I mean, that's why it's under Marvel's sub publishing group. Because, you know, the graphic novel stuff, you had, let's see, History of Violence, you had Road to Perdition, you had Wanted. I think the most successful was V for Vendetta. I remember that making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of those were ones that, it's funny, it just takes me back to an article I wrote years ago. So many of those were graphic novel / comic adaptations that people weren't aware were comic adaptations. Yeah, V for Vendetta being right there with, what is it, Johnny Depp and...
From Hell?
From Hell, you know, was another one that just based on that there was a graphic novel on a shelf and a writer that studios knew, they were like, yep, sure, here's $30, $50 million, go make it. And I do think that's kind of how this was looked at. But I'm not surprised with an R rating that they were like, you can't, because we've gotten better, you know, at it. I can't say we've gotten better at a society, but we've gotten better that R rated doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cap out at a certain level. Deadpool's an outlier, but so many R-rated films, you struggle. And for the longest time, certain theater chains, because let's remember, the two biggest chains are owned by religious groups, refuse to promote certain movies certain ways also. So that makes it difficult.
That makes it difficult. And when you say comic book, you automatically think teenager, preteen. And you can't really sell this, especially in 2010, as a comic book movie and not expect those audiences to want to see it. So that's why you see a lot of these. I mean, hell, I can't think of one Marvel film that's not PG-13.
The only one has been Deadpool and Wolverine.
Well, yeah. But as Adam said, those are outliers. When I went to see this, I did not even know that it was an actual real comic book. That's how much they tried underselling that it wasn't.
I mean, around the same time, Oblivion, that movie. That
love bringing that movie up.
That you like it was written as a comic book. He was like, hey, I'm going to pitch this as well. And everybody ignored it. And then he went back and said, hey, this is a completed comic book. He was lying out of his ass, and then it got bought. And then he just scrapped ever releasing the comic book.
Matt, Oblivion is Adam's South Park.
Yeah, except South Park is actually good. It has cultural impact. I think most people, when they see Oblivion, they go, oh, that's the one where he dies over and over.
Yeah. Right?
Well, technically.
Technically you're not wrong. But speaking of deaths, I mean, I guess it makes sense that Lionsgate would pick this up because so they saw the blood and viscera and said, oh, we keep making hand over fist with these Saw movies. Let's take a superhero movie.
Well, this is 5 years after Man-Thing, too, by the way, which they had. So
yeah, and they had Punisher Warzone.
Yeah.
I guess they're like, all right, one of these has to make money eventually.
At this time, it was Blade. I mean, Blade was the only R-rated one you could look at to say that hit.
Yeah.
The other one, I think, of the R-rated cut of Daredevil was only a DVD release. That wasn't in theaters.
No, that wasn't in theaters.
It was a big hit that way where people went, hey, you know, if you let filmmakers do their stuff, these films are better.
And I remember this not making money. As a matter of fact, that was a kind of a big deal where it was released and it was neck and neck with How to Train Your Dragon. And they had initially announced that Kick-Ass had won the weekend, but then they went and they counted the Thursday box office and they're like, yeah, it actually lost. So it didn't even win a weekend. And I remember this kind of dying a pretty bad death in theaters and it not really catching a cult status until afterwards.
No, well, the only person who won either way was Christopher Mintz-Plasse because he's in both.
Oh yeah, that's right.
It reminds me that way of like Scott Pilgrim. You know, this is a film that has a stunning cult following. I mean, people talk about the film even more than the comic, but if not for the proliferation back then of DVDs, especially Netflix male DVDs, this never would have caught on. And if you do this today, streaming does not do what video rentals did to give these things a second life.
No, it does not. There's no second life,
really. Money's not there.
Yeah, and I remember I did go see this opening weekend, but as I mentioned last week, it was with a not really nice person, and we would fight all the time to the point where cops were at our house like every other weekend because neighbors were complaining. And this fight was about, you guys ready? I wanted to see the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot had come out because I hadn't seen it yet, and she wanted to see this. Well, she ended up winning. We ended up going to see this opening weekend. And honestly, boys, I gotta say, this movie, I cannot believe it's already been 15 years since this movie was out, and I have revisited it maybe twice before watching it for this podcast. I never go back to this film.
I'll hit mine. You know what, I'm kind of the same way. I did not see this in theaters. I didn't see it until much later. In fact, I don't think I saw it until after Garrett and I were fighting about Iron Man 3. In fact, I think the three of us might have been fighting about
Iron Man 3. We were all fighting about that.
But it was about deconstructing superheroes and that kind of stuff. So I was like, okay, you know what? I've heard that's what Kick-Ass is. And that's when I watched it. And I think I've watched it again once since. And then again for this. Not for any, you know, we'll get into it as we discuss it. But it was much later. Never saw a theatrical viewing. Though Garrett, I'm going to say, and I don't think I've ever said this before in regards to that person, she was right in that weekend.
Well, yeah, me and Matt have already had that discussion.
But this is one where it was just kind of like, hey, I'm glad it had a second life on video because that is where I got to find it.
Well, this is very much, if this came out in the mid to late 90s, this has cult film written all over it. This would have been like The Crow, where it would have had its own like devoted audience and cosplay and, you know, its own subculture.
You mentioned cosplay. I got to say, the year after this was out, lots of Kick-Ass and Hit Girls at Comic-Con the year after.
That's cool and creepy, depending on which way you're going.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of brothers taking their sisters and dads taking their daughters. The dad would dress as the Cage character, and it was like that. You know, it was nothing really too creepy. I was shocked when I went, because I ended up going by myself that year, and I looked around, and there's just a ton of Hit Girl and Kick Asses. So, yeah, it did kind of catch on with that crowd.
I also did not see this in theaters, and I just find it funny how every couple years there's an anomaly where you have two movies that are basically the same premise get released in the same year. I call it the Arma Impact Syndrome, where you had two asteroid movies come out in 1998.
Oh yeah.
In this, you had Kick-Ass and James Gunn's movie Super both come out the same year, which are both like, what if a real person put on a superhero outfit and fought?
And that movie's terrible. I don't think I'd seen it when this was out. I think I saw it maybe the year after. I think I went and Redboxed it or something. And I still haven't revisited that one. I wasn't too excited for this weekend, I got to say. And this movie was coming out and I was going to go see it. I didn't know really what to expect, but I didn't really care because it wasn't Iron Man, which, you know, we'd get Iron Man 2 that same year, wouldn't we? Iron Man 2 came out the same year. I wasn't really expecting much when I sat down to watch this.
I didn't see this until the second one was coming out. And the only reason I cared about the second one is because Jim Carrey was in it.
Yeah, I think you and I had those discussions. We were friends at that time.
Yeah, because I was like, really? Jim Carrey's involved in this? That was during the period where he was getting very selective with what he was doing and basically went into semi-retirement until that blue hedgehog came with a dump truck full of money. And I would think he's made more money than he did in the 90s.
Yeah.
But this came out. And it had some pretty strong defenders. Roger Ebert was not one of them, though.
No.
He pulled out his own naginata and tore this to ribbons. And a lot of people, including people involved in the movie, some of the actors, found it hypocritical that people were so quick to talk about the language. You have a 12-year-old saying the C word, but said nothing about the violence that she inflicts. Because let's remember, this is America.
Yeah, and you go overseas, and that word is like just a commonality out there. Like, it's so funny how we take language and we twist it the way we do and turn it way worse than other countries see it. And that's true with this as well. We'll talk about it. But yeah, that was a big topic of conversation. I remember people really coming down on that. And as Adam mentioned, there were parent groups and everything else that were trying to encourage people to not see this.
There's also another reason why I was dreading going to see this, but I'll save it for when we get into the movie. There was a reason I put it off for a few years. The movie opens with a narration by the title character talking over lines that are basically Superman. Like, it's a bird, it's a plane, all those. It even looks like the credits you would see in a Superman movie because they're in the sky. And we cut to a scene that looks like it's straight out of The Boys, if you've seen that show. Of a guy with a cape, everyone's watching him, jumping off a skyscraper, and you think he's going to fly, only to then subsequently smack into the hood of a car and be killed instantly.
Yeah, and you mentioned voiceover. We talk about voiceover a lot on the show, mostly in a negative connotation. There is one time in this entire movie where the narration is extremely bad and obnoxious. Here, I think for the most part, though, I think the narration works for this film, because if you're going to tell a comic book movie like this and you want thought bubbles, this is the way to do it.
Well, it's the one medium. Comic books are the one medium where you almost can excuse voiceover anytime you want, because it's crucial to, a lot of times it's crucial to storytelling, because you have such a limited amount of space to do dialogue with the panels. And the voiceover, basically from Sam Raimi's Spider-Man on, everyone started doing that, because Daredevil had the voiceover for a lot of it. So I felt like this was just following the trend at the time.
And it these type of movies are the types where I want it. I think of Daredevil, Ben Affleck's Daredevil. and John Favreau. You know, there's a lot of voiceover in that. I think it works for comic book movies of a certain type, and I want more of it. Some of my favorite comics have zero dialogue, but they have the internal dialogue going on. So I don't mind it. I think it works well when it needs to. But I do think in a lot of movies, it's just fucking lazy way to get exposition out that they don't get on screen that you can obviously tell is added in an ADR booth later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my part of it, too, is it's disassociated with what you're seeing on screen.
Yes. I got to ask, for the straight up very beginning of this film, when it starts off with either call it homage or ripoff of the Superman credits, did it piss you off, or were you like, okay, I know what I'm getting?
I got to be honest. You know what? I didn't make that association. So I thought the association when they jumped off the building and it landed on a car. Oh, God damn. Now I have to watch it again to see those credits because I did not think about that.
Yeah, well, speaking of things that you forgot about, as we're introduced to the main character, Dave, played by Aaron. He's just credited as Aaron Johnson. This is before he went by Taylor Johnson. I forgot he used to look like this.
Yeah, me too. I did too.
If you put this, Godzilla, and Kraven and watch that as a trifecta, you would not know you're watching the same actor in all three films.
I will give the movie this. I, at the time, railed about Tobey Maguire playing Spider-Man because he didn't look like a high school kid. Well, nobody did in those movies.
Yeah.
And you cast a guy who actually looks like a teenager. I don't think he was at the time. He was probably early 20s. But it's actually believable for the first time in one of these types of movies where you have someone that looks age-appropriate to where they're supposed to be.
Absolutely. And I don't have anything negative to say about Taylor Johnson in this. I think he's pretty good. There's one performance that outshines them all. We'll get to it. But I think as the title character, I think Johnson's fine.
I feel like Adam's about to unleash.
I do too, actually.
Because I know how he feels about Godzilla. But.
Yeah, let him build up his radioactive fire before he unleashes here.
I had seen him in so many crap movies that he was the part I was looking forward to the least when I finally got around to this. And I think he actually does a pretty damn good job. I think he's likable. I think he fits the part. I think he looks teenagerish enough. I mean, he looks much more like a teenager than even I did when I grew up watching 90210. So he may be the most accurate since we were getting, I don't know, what, actual late teens in Buffy's. So I think, I don't know, there's something pretty fucking charming about the way that he plays this role in this likable doofus, you know, even from the get-go.
I think he plays unassuming very well, which is crucial to this character. For a guy who's British, that's a pretty convincing accent. That can be very hard to do. But I remember this was like night and day, because it was right before this, or maybe a week after they announced Andrew Garfield is the new Spider-Man. And I'm like, he also does not look like a high school kid, and he's way too good looking.
Andrew Garfield looked 40 at 16.
Yeah.
He
looked 40 in Social Network.
I was like, okay, that means then Andrew Garfield Spider-Man is going to be in college or, you know, 25. They're like, nope, we're taking it back to high school. I'm like, what planet of toxic waste did everyone walk to when they start to age? Especially because, like, you look at Aaron Taylor Johnson now. I mean, he's in his 30s. He's still a young guy. But he looks not like there's no trace of this. I mean, for one thing, I'm so used to him being ripped. He will do for the sequel, but I think he's good here. And I also love how one of his best friends is the other Quicksilver.
Yeah, I know. And he's also Jeffrey Dahmer. But this, I want to say something, and this has nothing to do with Johnson's performance or any other performance, actually. It takes me quite a while, boys, to get into this film. Because we're opening up and we have these homages to other comic books and references to comics, as people who know me from the Deadpool reviews, no, I really don't like that approach to these things. And also, you know what really takes me out too? They tell you in screenwriting, try to keep modern references out of it, because eventually those references date. We have references to MySpace here. We have so many little things where I'm just really taken out of the moment, and it's tough for me to get in. Now, there is a part where I do have an in, but this movie takes a hell of a long time to get going.
So you touched on something that I was going to get into later. I think that I don't know if this is true of the graphic novel because I haven't read it. I feel like the B storyline that we're introduced to is far more compelling than the A one with him. And to me, it doesn't ruin the movie. But when I'm not as interested in the title character as I am one of the other storylines going on, it does kind of undermine the overall movie in my estimation.
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
I agree with that.
But he's just your typical kid. I mean, granted, he goes to a school where there's metal detectors, which unfortunately a lot of people have to do, even more so after this. But he is what Peter Parker should be presented as. Loser, small group of friends, picked on. I mean, the only thing that, I mean, he does get mugged, but it's not in school. It's like they're leaving a comic book store. This guy, two friends, you know, I mentioned Evan Peters, who this was before he was Quicksilver. It's before either of them were Quicksilver. Clark Duke, who I had seen, the only thing I had seen him in was Hot Tub Time Machine.
Oh, God, that's where I knew him from. I was trying to see if I recognized him. I didn't bother looking up on IMDb. I was just like, where the hell do I know that? Yeah, that's where I recognize him from.
I recognize him from trailers and things because I don't think I've seen a movie with him. But as they're leaving, especially with them, the time they spend in the comic book store and everything else. And I got to say, I cannot believe the amount of IPs that are allowed to be spread throughout this film. And it's got to be just because of the people involved in the making of the movie and the comic and their goodwill. Because there's no way this much IP is allowed in posters and showing comics of five different companies throughout the course of this film. And it's got to be just good graces. But it's as they're leaving and they're all in there, I can't help but think of the Frog Brothers from The Lost Boys.
Oh, yeah, good call.
And thinking of a comic book store and that type of nerdiness that just, not completely, but it takes me back to that type of filmmaking.
Well, their dynamic, especially in the comic book store, initially worried me because I was like, I already lived this type of dialogue with Kevin Smith's early movies like Mallrats and Clerks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that whole scene about the kryptonite condom. I thought it was going to be more of that ilk, but I like how all their conversations are strictly about either the other characters in the movie or just why there are no superheroes in real life. And I love how Evan Peters is just so blatantly like, because they would get their ass kicked or because they would die, which is the uniform answer. But that kind of ties into every kid at some point has that thought of being a superhero. Like, yep. I think that's why it's surprising it took this long for someone to tackle this premise in this context.
Definitely. And you mentioned when Kevin Smith does it and he talks, you know, he has rambling about Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back and all that. I think that is there not for character's sake, but to show what he knows and what he thinks about those particular properties. And it's a real look at what I know mentality. I think here these characters naturally talk about these things because you see these nerds like this. That's exactly how they talk. I think this is more for character's sake, and I think it works in that way.
And I will say one of the things I do like, we finally have a comic book store that looks like a comic book store, which I complain about in a lot of movies or TV shows where they I'm sorry, comic book stores don't look like public libraries.
I know. It took me back to True Romance, where Christian Slater's character was running a comic book store. That's how comic book stores look. And you're right, they don't do that too often. Not all comic book stores are Barnes and fucking Noble.
They also don't have $1,000 statues unsecured just everywhere you turn around asking to be knocked off and broken. They don't have $1,000 books laying in a rack. It's just no.
So as they're sitting in the comic book store, they're talking about, you know, how come no one's ever been a superhero? And we're introduced to one of their classmates who is played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who basically overnight became a sensation because of Superbad.
And so he's here. And that's only where I still know him from, Superbad.
Oh, he will always be McLovin. It's going to be like how it took DiCaprio, a decade to stop being just the obnoxious kid from Titanic. Maybe he's got the John Cryer syndrome, where he will always be Ducky until proven otherwise. But he is the Harry Osborn of this movie because he's the rich kid who's seemingly got everything he wants. And he's got the father who's the villain. Because this came out at the time where if you needed a villain, you just called Mark Strong and he picked up every single time.
Yes. I remember him being in a lot of these. And there's something that's going on here that I wanted to point out. You mentioned Spielberg earlier, Matt. What they are doing here is an inverse of what Spielberg does, where Spielberg does a lot of stuff in his early work, actually, where there's a missing father character. Here, all of these characters are missing mothers. And I think that's a curious dynamic that you do with these particular characters, because you respond differently if you don't have a different parent around. And I think that is something that I really paid attention to this time while watching is how they handled the fact that none of these characters don't have a mother.
That's a good point. It's not one I thought of. And yeah, each of them have got a father figure, at least, if not a real father. And all of them act or are completely different types of fathers to the children that they're with.
There's also they take from Superman and that it's something human that kills one of his parents with the aneurysm.
I was messed up.
It's kind of, I mean, look, the violence in this movie, which we'll talk about, garnered a lot of stuff, but the fact that plays almost as a joke.
That's a fear of mine. That is a nightmare of mine. And the way it did it was just, I mean, that's as real as it gets.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think because it's played so matter-of-fact, but it's juxtaposed with him standing in front of her grave in the pouring rain, like the cliche, I think makes it even funnier. So Dave talks about how he wants to be a real-life superhero, and it's not until they get mugged by a couple of thugs as they're leaving the comic book store that he decides to take action and spend $100, which, let's remember, this is a high school kid in New York. He's probably not coming from a lot of money. The cheap, like, scuba diving equipment.
This was a good way to take it because you have these characters, and of course, they're referencing Spider-Man a lot during this, but they have such sophisticated suits. This is not a sophisticated suit. This is something you could just go on Amazon and just get a fucking scuba suit and just go out with. So I do like the fact that they keep it grounded, that do have the high sophisticated suits that you're used to in comic book films.
But what also keeps it grounded is that the main villain of this movie is just a mobster. He's not fighting a supervillain. He's not fighting someone belt on world domination. It's your prototypical New York mob boss, because we're introduced to him interrogating a guy who claims his drug deal went wrong because he was attacked by someone who looks like Batman, but it's not Batman. They are addressing that this is a world where superheroes are well known. Like, this doesn't take place in a world where superheroes don't exist, which I appreciate.
Yeah, they actually do exist in this world. I noticed that too. That's a good way to approach it.
I mean, Matthew Vaughn is also a huge Bond fan because he takes the license to kill scene and puts the guy in the microwave.
Yep, I thought of that. And he does a lot of Bond references when he eventually gets to X-Men too. There's a lot of winking at the audience, but like I said, it's not obnoxious until later on in the film.
Well, it's also the violence in this for the first two acts. It's purposely over the top because it makes you lower your guard for when it sort of goes into a different direction later on. Because, I mean, it's plausible, but it's this giant explosion of like a blood squib going, when the guy explodes in the microwave. But I also love how what follows that scene is him going into a limo and talking about mixing ices, which we are all guilty of doing at some point in our lives.
Last week.
But this is the Osborne dynamic, even as it was portrayed in the first Raimi movie. Like, if you've never read a comic, you know that's kind of what they're pulling
from. Yeah, you know what they're referencing here for sure.
Although these two don't look like father and son, at least I could buy Willem Dafoe and James Franco being related.
I don't know, man. And I think Plass gets a lot of heat just for being known as McLovin. And you know what? If you're known for one role, great. You've made a dent in society. And that's something that everybody who gets into acting tries to do, where they try being known, and it's hard to get that to happen. Here, I think he's pretty good. He's much better than I remember, actually. There are moments where his dad is doing what he's doing, and all Plass wants to be is a kid. He just wants to be a normal high school kid. And he can't be that because his family obviously has a lot of money, but it looks so dark and so dank, boring up there. All he wants to be a kid. And I think he portrays that pretty well.
Was also got the AJ Soprano thing of, I know my dad is a criminal.
Yeah, for sure.
There's not that scene of him driving and he goes, Dad, are you in the mafia?
And at least they don't hide that. It's not another B plot for most of this film. He knows what his dad does. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's a trope I hate. Whereas they're going into the movie theater, Dave and his friends are leaving. They've gone to see The Spirit, or The Spirit 3, which... The first one wasn't even good enough to warrant a sequel, but this takes place in a world where that got three movies. So clearly that's a world that Frank Miller never existed.
I want to apologize to these characters just for going and seeing that movie.
Oh my God.
Well, speaking of involvement, they cut to a father and a daughter standing in the middle of nowhere, and he is preparing to shoot his daughter with a gun.
Okay.
Which, like, if you knew nothing about this movie,
yes,
and you walked in, you would be like, what the fuck is this?
Yes, let's talk about this.
It was me on first watch. The first time I saw this film, I didn't watch the trailer or anything for it because I'd just been told, hey, you got to get around to this. So I didn't even know, I didn't realize Nicolas Cage was even in this film. So it gets to this scene and I'm just like, did this movie just skip to something else? What the hell is going on?
Yeah. Let's talk about this. So we're going to talk about this a lot when we talk Matthew Vaughn later on. Matthew Vaughn has a very dark heart. And this scene has to be played perfectly because it could have gone really poorly. And I think he plays it exactly right, where you can't do a beat longer than when he does when Hit Girl gets shot here. He plays it exactly right. But the dark heart that Matthew Vaughn has is clearly on display here. I haven't seen too many Matthew Vaughn films, but the only time I haven't seen it is when he did his X-Men film, which we'll eventually talk about again. But I think here it's done perfectly. And Nicolas Cage is look, at this point, he was, what, 3 years removed from Ghost Rider, and which is a performance we'll talk about eventually. Nicolas Cage has a way of getting into films and overtaking them. I think here his performance is pretty good. There's only one time where he takes me out of the film, which he normally does when he's in these films. He's like the Aaron Rodgers of movies, where if he's going to do it, he's going to do it his own way. And he has to have this be done his way, this be done his way. He's not really directable. Here, I think he's pretty good. And I love the fact that he based it on Adam West. I think that's a really nice touch.
I think that's what makes this work. Not only is he is dressed like the post-Adam West Batman, but he has Adam West's inflections.
Yes.
Which makes it the ultimate tribute to Batman, because let's be honest, if Nick Cage had it his way, he would have starred as Batman, not Superman.
Well, he's a Superman guy, I thought, though. I thought he was wanting to be Superman.
Yeah, well, he also has a Ghost Rider tattoo, so clearly he's not picky about choosing.
Yeah, then he named his kid, I believe, is Cal, mm-hmm. or Kal-El.
Yeah.
So, I mean, shoot, he's lost tens of millions of dollars buying Superman stuff over the years. Mm-hmm.
So this was the casting I dreaded, because this came out during the period where Nicolas Cage made one good movie for every five.
Yeah, if that.
Because he had some past due taxes to pay. So
he was making everything.
Yeah.
Like now, the entire history of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
I think he is great here because he's not the main character. However, I find the stuff with Hit Girl and Big Daddy to be far more interesting than the Kick-Ass main story. I think because, and I can't speak to the graphic novel, like I said, we finally have something that is indirectly, but also at the same time being like a straight bullet, critical that Batman is fucking insane and wrong in a lot of ways for having a junior partner that he brainwashes into a crusade against crime. This is both a harsh criticism of Robin, but also the only authentic Robin we've had on screen.
And this is another brilliant screenwriting decision, because they did change it from the comic for the good. Everything they changed from the comic is for the good. Because in the book, this character, this Nicolas Cage character, they wrote him here as a former cop. In the book, he's an accountant who wants to be a cop. And so he makes up a whole charade about how he is now a crime fighter and everything. Here they make it authentic, and that was one of many great screenwriting decisions they made here to make these characters. Look, Nicolas Cage is not the best father in this film. He loves his daughter. You can tell he really loves her, but you could question his fathering methods. But I think the way Matthew Vaughn plays this is brilliant, because he makes him just quirky enough to be likable, and you can tell he actually loves that daughter. In the book, it does not come off as love. It comes off as a charade to get famous.
I like what Nicolas Cage does enough, but I can't watch this movie without realizing I'm watching Nicolas Cage be Nicolas Cage. It's just there. I mean, he's a distraction because of who he is, and so much was going on at this time. It's fine. I feel like I'm watching two separate movies that are kind of stitched together.
But Matt had it perfect, where he said he's worked here because he's not the main character. You get him as a background character, which is the way to play it.
Well, no, absolutely that helps. But the movie cuts away whenever it just decides it wants to cut. Not for story reasons, because it's just time to cut, because you film Nicolas Cage and Chloe Grace Moretz for a little bit. So, and that's the only thing. I don't feel that it weaves together nearly as much as it thinks it does.
Well, part of that, I think, is because this plot, as far as the mechanics, it's very bare bones. Mm-hmm. It's a revenge story on this side, and it's a mistaken identity on the other side. So I feel like a lot of the stuff that is incorporated is stuff that, and I can't speak to the graphic now, it feels like they're compounding it, creating new problems, just to pad this out to a two-hour runtime.
It is longer than it needs to be.
And this was the role that made Chloe Grace Moretz a star.
Yep.
She got Carrie because of this, I think, in a certain way. And this is also my argument for why everyone says you can't do Robin in a movie as a teenager. I'm like, two words, Hit Girl. Nobody questioned that. Well, the people who questioned it were the ones that got on their moral high horses.
Yeah, I was going to say, it did get questioned. But I like her a lot in this. I saw brighter things for her after this. She did do Carrie a few years later. But I just saw her in a movie just a couple years ago where it was like a one-woman play, pretty much, where she's in an airplane for 2 hours fighting gremlins that are stuck on the plane. She's done really weird career choices since this movie, but here I think she's great. I think she utters these words. See, people who railed against this movie, if they saw the context of where she's doing it and where she's coming from and where her origins are to know these words, I think they would like her more, and they wouldn't get on their high horse about it. I think she's really good.
Well, it's also the movie calls out how fucked up this is. So I never feel like it's endorsing his behavior, but it's also the, as I said, this is the best Robin commentary we've had in a movie. And I use this as the example of, you can do Robin. Now it sounds like that's not going to happen at all, because Brave and the Bold is probably going to get canned.
Based on who they had to write and direct it, I'm not going to argue after The Flash. But yeah, I think Chloe Moretz absolutely steals the show for damn good reason. And yeah, I think this and Umbrella Academy showed that you can do Robin right.
Yeah, except now Aidan Gallagher's too old to be Damian Wayne.
Yeah, but it shows that you can take someone in that age range. You just have to admit this is what they are, and you have to do it the way this film is. It's messed up. You can't have a teenage or preteen vigilante and not be destroying the mental faculties of that kid.
Yeah, especially with the backstory that they have, which will be expounded upon momentarily. But Dave returns home, and he finds the package with the costumes, so he puts on his scuba gear, and he goes out to fight crime. And much like Peter Parker going after the guy who shot Uncle Ben, Kick-Ass, which he calls himself, goes after the two guys who mugged him and his friend early on. And he gets a harsh dose of reality real quick in the form of being stabbed in the stomach.
And this is when I finally start really getting into this film, is this particular scene. Because it ups that ante. We are finally seeing him, quote-unquote, in action. But when he gets stabbed like this, it finally makes me feel for the guy.
I think this is when, I mean, it's been clear that we're going to dissect superhero genre completely and vigilantism completely. This is just like, okay, we're going to do it, and we're not going to do it in the nice, touchy-feely, friendly kind of way. This is going to be very clear that, yeah, it doesn't work. Or if it works, this is what happens. And it's a nice thought.
With also it answers the question of, oh, is this guy, just because he puts on a suit, gonna dumb luck his way into apprehending these guys, which kind of happens later on. But I like that they start with the, oh, you are gonna get a harsh dose of reality immediately, because he doesn't bleed out. The movie's not that dark. This wasn't written by Lars von Trier, but he nevertheless gets taken to the hospital. And this is kind of how they get around quote-unquote superpowers, because he gets metal implants,
yeah,
which give him not in like invulnerability, but it kind of nullifies in a certain way his pain index, so he has a higher tolerance, and I guess it makes his punches hit harder,
which he's Wolverine is, without the healing factor.
Yeah, exactly, which makes it clever.
He says I look like Wolverine when they look at the skeleton, which I'm pretty sure might be the same one that used the first prop from the original X-Men movie of his exoskeleton. They just found it. Matthew Vaughn took it from the Fox parking lot after he got fired out of Revenge.
I found this clever. This is the way to make him a superhero without making him a superhero. It's just give him this, a little bit of a quirk to go out in those streets.
But this leads to a lot of people thinking that he was, yes, me as an openly gay man, I'm going to talk about this. I have major issues with all the gay panic text in this movie.
Yeah, there's a ton of it.
It borders on homophobia, not just because of this, but also Hit Girl constantly uses the word gay when she's referring to his taser later on, which makes this really feel like it was written by a 15-year-old boy. And I know it's not, but this is one of the things that I think really dates the movie in a negative way.
Definitely.
I'll say that whether or not it's acceptable, it was normalized at the time. If you didn't like something, it would be, oh my God, that's gay. This was before the it's okay to be gay PSAs and stuff like that that you'd have. So it was common, whether or not it was acceptable. And even just bros talking about that type of thing that would have happened to a buddy of mine, that would have been the type of homophobic type of content that one would have made to another.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. And I think the first part is very funny, because they found him without his clothes. They assume he got raped. I think that's funny in a way, because this came out like it was the origins of social media. So things got very exaggerated very quickly. But it's the fact that so much of the girlfriend subplot is just that same joke. Oh, I think.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. But you know what? If you don't like it here, you would hate the book then, because they really expand on this and that.
There's and if you know who there. Mark Miller is, and the way that he, let's just say his very right, Americanized right-wing leanings, I don't think you'd be surprised.
But, you know, he goes, I do like that everyone thinks he's kind of a badass because he survived getting stabbed, but there's the, okay, he was found without clothes. How do you explain that? But I also love that this takes place in a world where MySpace was the most popular social media.
God.
Because I never had MySpace. I had Facebook, of course, and I had AIM instant messaging, which people in my demographic used far more than MySpace.
Yeah, I had a MySpace. In fact, I think that's where me and Adam reconnected, was on MySpace.
Eric, Yahoo chat rooms.
Oh, God. Yes.
ASL. Paychex location.
Yes. Paying by the hour to get on those chat rooms. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying about putting these in this film is, yeah, it was okay to say in 2010 and people would laugh at it and say, oh yeah, I do that. Now we watch that and it does not date the film well, along with the subtext that you were mentioning earlier, Matt. You watch this and it kind of takes you out of it.
And it's crazy because, of course, MySpace would never go away. Like, it was so much better than Facebook because you personalized your page, you had music, you had all this other stuff that you did when you went to it. And I guess it would be like, you would never think to not make a Twitter reference today, yeah, because of course it's not going to go anywhere. Well, we'll see in 5 years. All this could be gone. You know, we could be having the same discussion by the time we get to phase four of the MCU. All this shit could be gone.
You're right.
Maybe it'll be like the Total Recall remake where we all just get cell phones implanted into our hands.
You know, for somebody who hates that Neuralink movie, you reference it all the time.
Because that's the one thing I remember from that movie. That and the stupid thing of an elevator that takes you to the center of the earth. Well, for the record, this 2010, I also love this, came out the same year as The Social Network. And I used to think there was a period where I'm like, okay, Christopher Mintz-Plasse needs to call Jesse Eisenberg's agent and be like, how did you get the Mark Zuckerberg role? I need something like that to have people take me seriously. But unbeknownst to him, his girlfriend puts up a post about why she's involved with the drug dealer. I don't know. This is where the movie gets a little murky with how things kind of interconnect. But he gets lucky because on a night out where he's saving a cat from a roof, which is the most stereotypical thing ever, so much of The Incredibles made fun of it.
Yeah. Well, I liked it, though.
Because it shows cats are assholes because it won't come with him. It's the truest thing in this movie. And there's people that are running away, falls down. The guy hits the car. They get arrested. Of course, everyone's there to see it, so they think he did it. This is kind of how he starts to build his reputation. Remember, this came out also at a time where YouTube was not advertised to shit like it is now, and it was actually a fully functional site where you could just watch videos and be happy.
Yeah, right.
Dave, as Kick-Ass, goes to the drug dealer's house, tells them to stop harassing her, and once again, the movie is very smart. He gets his ass kicked because there's also the comment of Big Daddy watching the video and he goes, they should call him Ass Kit.
And that's the time, too, where he does that little hesitant laugh that I love. This is when I really like Cage, is when he's doing this shit.
This is where, if you know Adam West, it is spot on with the AR-15 is a smaller caliber version of what design. Especially when he's in the costume later on, there's a line where I'm like, oh, that is straight out of Adam West. But Hit Girl does show up, and this is where the C word gets dropped.
Mm-hmm.
That was almost like the battle cry for the people who wanted to burn this movie to the ground, was just that one word, which if you've seen any Guy Ritchie movie, they use it a lot.
Exactly. Like I said, it's commonplace out there. I think of all the things Hit Girl does in this, I think the most shocking thing she does is when she takes these swords and she puts it right through that chick. It's pretty brutal, the stuff.
Oh, she doesn't discriminate.
Yeah, exactly. Which I like.
The language never gets to me. Maybe that's because I got a buddy of mine, Garrett, that we used to quote unquote work with on Australia. We still chat and we still call each other that very lovingly.
Uh-huh.
A weekly basis. Love you, B. Peter, the same situation. It's just so, I don't know. I think that was so overblown. It's kind of ridiculous. Dude's European. It's commonplace. You might as well just freaking go to McCuntles. It's such a common phrase.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But this is another problem, though, that I have with this film, is that the reason that everybody is intersecting is just so convenient for the way that it's done that it really doesn't make sense. But it's a fun, just really over-the-top action sequence. And we needed it, because the ones that we've gotten so far have been kind of just blasé, getting your ass kicked. We need that to flip on its head and kind of start to feel for our heroes in a good way.
I agree.
Quote unquote heroes.
I agree. And there's something that Matthew Vaughn does here. He starts here and he'll do it for the rest of the film. That is the most Tarantino-esque of anything. He's obviously a huge Tarantino fan, because what Tarantino does is he takes music that he grew up on, that he loved, and he'll put them in his films to contextualize what's going on with the action. He'll do it in a loving and very good way because it fits the scenes. Here we have Vaughn grabbing John Murphy's soundtracks for both 28 Days Later and Sunshine and putting them in these scenes. And I think they work really well. Around this time, Walking Dead did an episode where they took John Murphy's main theme from Sunshine and they put it in a scene where the group was traveling somewhere, and it just did not fit. It reminds me of when I did one independent film. We hired this composer. We were excited to get him because he had done a ton of commercial stuff and he had done a ton of epic trailer music. And he did what we'll talk about when we get to Firestarter, where he gave us his music and he didn't even watch the film. He's like, just put this wherever you want. And when we tried doing that in the editing room, we're like, there's nowhere to put this where it fits. I think Vaughn takes these soundtracks, these brilliant soundtracks that John Murphy did for 28 Days Later and Sunshine, and he injects them in these scenes very well. I think it really works.
Well, it needs injections because people are getting limbs cut off.
Yeah.
People are getting stabbed. Like, this is, I mean, shocking is being kind, because this level of hyper-violence, you really have not seen outside of Punisher Warzone, which is a living cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in a very positive way, which we'll talk about later on this year. It's made more shocking by the fact it's done by a 12-year-old girl.
Exactly. Like
that's the whole point of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a commentary. You could look at this if you want to read between the lines of this age group being consumed by all the cliche things, Grand Theft Auto, rap music. It's corrupting people's brains. Like, that's very much what this is playing on, those type of cliches. But she makes the mistake of turning her back, gets saved by Big Daddy sniping the guy that was coming from the door. And Kick-Ass leaves and decides, you know what, I'm done. But not before they literally do the Batman thing of just showing up at his house.
How many times does he quit in this movie? He must quit at least two, three times. I get it. It's the Superman 2 thing. It's the Spider-Man thing. The famous comic of Spider-Man putting his costume in the garbage. You know, we see that from Kick-Ass. I would say too many times. I do think it's a flaw of the film.
Yeah, he tries to quit. They basically strong-arm him into saying, yeah, you left your taser. And if the cops found that, you would have been screwed. So you shouldn't really give this up. And he says, like, we'll be watching or something along those lines,
yeah.
Which is also the cliche Batman line. And he turns around and they're already gone, except there's no,
that's what that feels like.
God, that line is so fucking bad. Which I also appreciate. I like that Nick Cage is not doing the stupid Christian Bale type of Batman voice when he's in costume.
No, but he's wearing the Batman from Nolan suit. So
yeah, I appreciate that it actually looks like bulky tactical gear.
Uh-huh, I get it. It would be like what Morgan Freeman would make the first time for Batman in Batman Begins. I still got the Nolan Batman feel just from looking at him in that suit.
You know what else I like, though? And it almost plays homage to the joke that everybody would make about the eye black and it disappearing. Because we get a long scene of just Nicolas Cage putting the eye black on before he even puts the mask on later on.
That's a good catch. Mm-hmm. And we see that Big Daddy is an artist, which is how they give his backstory. Which, did Romita do these drawings?
From what I understand, he did. Yep.
And it took 2 years just to do these alone. And this is kind of like what Ang Lee tried to do with this Hulk movie, with inserting panels in the editing to kind of make it look more complicated. But this is literal because they're drawings. And we're getting the backstory where Big Daddy used to be a cop. He was framed by the mob boss. That's why he's after him. And he's got the tragic backstory of his wife dying, killed herself. Mindy went to go live with her Uncle Ben.
Yep, with her Uncle Ben.
Who just happens to be his ex-partner.
You talked about the homaging other people, especially Tarantino. And I just watched Kill Bill last week. And this made me think of Orishi and how her entire backstory is done animation style. And that's what this feels like as well.
I also like how he gets called out. Like, this is the tools of brainwashing, I think is what the partner says when he shows up.
Yep.
I mean, I like this conversation where he's like, how'd you find me? He goes, one of us is still a cop.
Which, again, is a change from the book, a welcome change. He's an actual ex-cop instead of saying that he is.
But again, I still think it's everything just happens to be interconnected with this one mob boss, because it's also intercut that Frank, who's the Mark Strong character, goes after who he thinks is Kick-Ass, but he kills a poser who's dressed like him. So you have the mistaken identity, although he has the best reaction where he's like, why didn't he dress like fucking Spider-Man and have a Spider-Man party? There's Kick-Ass parties all of a sudden. Which also, like, this movie has a point about how quickly things can blow up on the internet, because he's immediately an overnight sensation, which makes sense because this came out at the same time as Charlie Bit My Finger, which is still one of the most popular videos in the history of the internet. So I guess it is plausible.
God, I don't even remember that.
I'm not sending it to you. You're going to look it up yourself. Cause
okay.
I've seen it so many times. It's like that in the Sneezing Panda.
Okay.
So Frank believes that Kick-Ass is doing all the attacks, not Big Daddy. which is why he kills the poser. And it's his son who comes up with a good idea of wish fulfillment. Let me pose as a superhero to lure him out, which I think this is actually pretty clever and something that I don't know anyone else who's thought of this.
Yeah, this is something that a comic book villain would come up with. And you're right. I'm surprised. I was going to ask you guys if it had been done before this.
I mean, kind of like when Mysterio was first introduced, except he literally posed as Spider-Man. So it's kind of different, but I'm sure there's examples and we'll get corrected in the comments. But I think this is actually one of the smarter things in the script as far as subverting tropes. The only absurd thing is that wig he's wearing. I'm like, there's no way that would stay on his fucking head. It looks taped on. So his plan is to lure Kick-Ass into the lumber warehouse. He picks him up in a Bruce Wayne-esque sports car, Tony Stark car. But he starts to befriend him a little bit because they share in the devil's lettuce.
Yeah, and I think another aspect of this movie that doesn't age very well is, I've mentioned the orchestral score. I think the orchestral score is great. But when you have Prodigy and you have Crazy with these guys driving around this car, it just immediately ages the fucking film.
Yeah, this is like an X-Men 2 when NSYNC comes on the radio.
Oh, God, yeah.
Instantly dating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But they go and the warehouse is on fire and everybody's already dead. So they do the cliché thing of, let's run into the burning building to try to save people. And then you realize how stupid that is because they're in there for not but 10 seconds and they're already suffocating. Because neither of these guys are in the best of shape.
Exactly.
And they're also, again, believably looking teenagers, so I don't have that, you know, disconnect in my head. But I also love how when he goes home, we find out the hidden camera was in the teddy bear, and none of them know what it is. And this is where they use the brilliant decision to use the 28 Days Later theme as Nick Cage is killing everybody in the warehouse.
Loved it. Loved it.
This is one of the scenes that's not overly graphic. He's just shooting people. I mean, this is basically like the BVS Batman scene where he's, instead of acrobatics, he's just shooting people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think Ben Affleck still has a higher body count, which is sad to say, because that's an official Batman movie.
I do like, Adam, you brought this up. The action earlier is not very good, but I like how Vaughn escalates it. We're going to get to a point where we're going to have a first-person shooter later on and a full-on action scene. I think it gets better as it goes, and I think that's the point of the action in the film.
So Frank realizes that it's not Kick-Ass who's been killing everybody, so he decides to make a move after Big Daddy. So Dave quits again, which might as well be the subtitle of every act he quits or exactly. tries to quit.
He is going to be the next James Bond as often as he quits.
I think there's no chance he's going to be James Bond.
Not now.
Not Bezos has anything to say about it. He goes to his girlfriend, and he, once again, we go back to the clearing up the fact that he's not gay, and they start dating, which this is the most unrealistic thing in the movie. There's no way she would fall for him.
Well, and in the book, she's a complete bitch. And Vaughn and Goldman did a really good job in the scripting phase of making her about as likable as you could. Millar, everybody yells at Miller for his treatment of women. And very fitting, by the way. And I know, Adam, you have strong feelings about that.
For the record, it's two different people. This is not Frank Miller. This is Mark Millar.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying is I don't think Millar likes women much better with the way he treats them in his books. I think Vaughn does a very good job of taking what could have been really bad, which is how it is in the book, and treating this girl like a normal teenage girl would, where she's just questioning what's happening instead of just unleashing on him like she does in the book.
Well, speaking of unleashing, I'm sure that's what happened in the bedroom. I mean, look, this movie is one fucked pie away from having Jason Biggs in it with the teenage horniness scattered throughout.
Which is going to get escalated next week.
Oh, God, that's right.
Yeah.
So this is where they get contacted again, and he unbeknowingly gives away their location. So they go to the safe house, everyone gets captured, and they're going to do basically the ending of Arkham Knight, where they unmask Batman in front of the world to see. They're going to do a live execution on the air.
And this is the one time where the violence is not fun to watch. The violence has been over the top, as we've talked about, and very in your face, but it's all been done tongue-in-cheek. Here, this is tough, guys. This is really tough to watch. He's just getting tortured in this room.
You know what? You're right. And I was wondering why you kind of hit it. At this point, I'm suddenly not enjoying myself a lot, and I don't really know why. And you hit it. Yeah, there's not a lot of fun going on right here for a movie that's all been really tongue-in-cheek and slapsticky, even at its most violent. It kind of slows down just to be really real-world brutal.
Well, this is where, not that the movie feels removed from reality, but it's exaggerated. This is the most toned-down thing in the movie. it helps stabilize things so that it can re-escalate for the big climactic set piece. I feel like it's done for a purpose. Hit Girl comes in, and once again, she is just walking death in this movie because she takes out everybody.
She takes out everybody, and I love the way Vaughn shoots this scene. At first, she's doing first-person shooter. Those are the video games that people would be playing at this time. This would be video games that a teenager her age would be playing. So they're playing that card. But I will say this. This is the one time that the Nicolas Cage-ness gets over the top because he's yelling in the background as the Sunshine soundtrack is playing, and it just takes me completely out of it because this is Nicolas Cage being his full-on most Nicolas Cage that he can be. And I hate him yelling, escalate the kryptonite! Like, all of that. Just like, oh, God.
Well, I feel like he went from playing Big Daddy in this to playing Nicolas Cage.
Exactly.
For this scene. Yeah.
Just this one time. This is the one time that I am taken completely out. Which, for Nicolas Cage performance, and we'll talk about it at least a couple in the next couple years, it's a good average if you're taken out one time by Nicolas Cage in a full two-hour film.
I think it's funny. Let's move on.
Okay. You like this? See, it's not supposed to be funny, though.
Because we realize, oh, yeah, this guy's certifiably insane. And now that he's dying, he's just letting his mental faculties are just evaporating minute by minute as he's bleeding out. He's also burning alive, so I don't think you're thinking logically at that point.
Yeah, that's true.
And he gives her a tearful goodbye as he... It's nice that someone dies in this movie, because that would have been really convenient if everybody survived. But this is the... trying to think of another film that where you have to kill off a crucial character to add stakes. I think they made the right call, because if you killed off Kick-Ass, it would have been kind of disingenuous, where it's like, oh, you named the movie after him and he dies three quarters of the way through.
And not to mention, if they had sequel aspirations, you'd have to pay Nicolas Cage in the sequel too. I think that kind of played into it as well.
No, he would have worked for scale based on his debt at this point.
But this is happening, and I don't get convinced that he's dead. One, I got the meta knowledge before I even watched this that I knew there's a sequel. I don't know whether or not he's in it. Never seen it. Don't let me know. But I'm like, why do I have the feeling they're actually not going to, that they're going to make this that super booky?
Adam, when they cut, he's burning. He's burning up. How do you not put that?
I know.
Okay.
He's the guy who watched Return of the Jedi and saw that giant pyre and said, oh yeah, Darth Vader can still get up.
It's a flesh wound.
I mean, it does kind of look like the Darth Vader armor in certain shots.
Yeah.
So he tries to quit again.
God, I hate this.
Now it's escalated. We have to fight the final boss. It becomes the raid where we have to work up the levels of his high rise to fight him. And fight them she does, but I'm so tired of hearing Joan Jett music in movies. And this is the most obvious song you can use. I mean, so much so that Shrek did this 10 years ago.
Joan Jett and Heart need to be banned from being used in films anymore, because you're right. They are both so overused. At this point, it wasn't, though. So it works for the scene in 2010. But in 2025, at this point, we've seen so many movies use this music. And I'm sure we'll see it more in this retrospective as we keep going.
I got to say, though, this, and not trying to be punny, but it is a kick-ass scene. I mean, it really is, from when she comes in this front lobby all the way through. I freaking love it.
Yeah, we also have Kick-Ass and Red Mist fight, quote unquote, but neither of these guys know how to fight.
Even though
they have weapons, they have no clue what they're doing.
There's a wonderful scene, and Matt, see if you get this. There's a wonderful scene in a Buffy episode where Xander has like a slapping fight with somebody in it. It's in slow motion. It gets treated as like this epic fight, but it's all slapping and so terribly done because nobody has any fight skills. And here, I got the exact same feeling where these guys, they haven't been trained in how to fight. Batman trains himself, and of course, by the time he gets to the bad guys, he's taking them all out. These guys don't know any of that. So I like the fact that they treat it like we're not having Corey Yen on set training these guys on how to do martial arts. They don't know how to do them, and I do like the fact that the movie treats it that way.
Yeah, because he tries to pick up the samurai sword, and it's too heavy for him.
Yeah.
He just gets hit once, that's it, which is also pretty realistic, because I'm pretty sure he would have a glass jaw. Then the movie takes kind of a shocking turn, because she gets strangled by Mark Strong. Like, they're not afraid to have actual violence be inflicted upon her.
Nope.
And that's where, like, I can understand a major studio just saying, no, we can't do it. It's part of the story. It makes sense. But I can see why Sony and so many places went, we're not going to do it. She's either got to be of legal age, or you can't have this specifically. Because not only is it male on female, it's an adult male on a 12-year-old girl. And even with all the stuff in this film, the language, the C word, the violence, the blood, this is the type of stuff that just is too much for a lot of people.
Even though we've seen this guy completely microwave somebody to literal pieces earlier in the film, it's still...
He wasn't in the room when that happened.
But what I'm saying is it's still strong to see somebody do this to a 12-year-old girl. So
right, it's marked strong to see it.
Drop the mic, we're done.
Yeah, I think we're going to wrap this up.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, the movie does wrap because he shows up with a jetpack.
Very Bond-ish. I thought of Bond with this as well.
I forgot about this because there's a scene where he sees something and she's like, you're going to need to read the instructions. I thought it was a car or something like that. I completely had forgotten that he shows up with a, math point, James Bond jetpack with, you know, machine guns coming out the side.
To be fair, Garrett made that point.
Here.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, it's wonderfully revealed, though. We have this ending fight, and of course this would happen. The good guy comes up with the big thing to save everybody, and I do like how this is played. Again, Matthew Vaughn knows what he's doing here. He knows the superhero tropes. Even in 2010, we had all of them before all Marvel took over, and he's playing them well. He has his cards, and he's playing each card perfectly.
Well, yeah, even to the point where the goons are going out and getting slaughtered left and right. Yep. And he's like, go out there. And you got the guy like, uh-uh.
Yeah.
It's just enough that it's just, we see wave after wave after wave. So it's nice to every now and then to see something different.
Yeah, and not since a Paul Verhoeven movie have I seen this many squibs. people get shot by the miniguns. And they go from Paul Verhoeven to James Cameron because he gets shot out the window like the guy from True Lies on the missile.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny. I mean, it's also a way to kill him off dramatically without showing him explode.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, this is all escalation, right? God, I didn't even think of James Cameron, but you're right. Now it's all coming back to me.
True Lies.
There's no Celine Dion music in this. God. And then Red Mist tries to go after them, and then they get away on the jetpack. And he actually quits successfully. They both retire. Finds out her name is Mindy. Mm-hmm. She gets readopted by the cop. And she's going to a school, and this leads into Carrie.
Well, it leads into Kick-Ass 2, which then leads into Carrie a few months after that, but yep.
Now, from my understanding, the ending of this movie is from the comic, specifically that line they quote, where he is in a new suit and he says, well, they get a load of me.
Yep, that's quoted straight from the book, yep, as well as Batman 89.
Yeah. Can't believe they got away with that line.
I can't believe they got away with a lot of this.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about violence and language. I'm talking about, as you mentioned, Adam, all the comic book references they've done in this. I know there were a few things that Marvel sneezed at, and they wouldn't allow certain things to go through. But the fact that they were able to get away with what they did is pretty remarkable.
I do laugh at the end where they're back in the comic book store, and everything the front-facing is the Kick-Ass comic book, and that's the actual Kick-Ass comic. That's all you see. If you're going to product place yourself, I mean, bravo.
Very, very clever on Vaughn's part. For sure.
Yeah, well, it's like, hey, if you like this movie, go read what inspired it, people.
Exactly.
Yeah, it does more for comics than Marvel movies do for comics, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, doesn't it insult you if you're a comic book fan like some of these have? All right, well speaking of being ashamed, now that Adam gave that terrible pun about 5 minutes ago, he gets to go first on his score. So on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Kick-Ass?
Yeah, it had been a while since I'd seen this, and I remember my first watch really being blown away just by how thoughtful and deconstructive of the superhero genre I felt this was. And I still feel that way, but not nearly as much. I do feel like there's a lot of parts throughout this film where it thinks it's a little smarter than it is. It thinks it's cuter and quippier than it really is. Sometimes it feels like it's a villain just monologuing a little too much. You caught me monologuing. But what it does is make you look at the films that had come out at the time. You release this movie 5, 6, 7 years later, and I think it would work even more than it did then, because the movie going public would have more of a reference. It's stunning how often these type of films are just a little bit ahead of its time. And the performances are pretty good well throughout. Aaron Taylor Johnson, he does really good here. I'm surprised how much I enjoy him. Nicolas Cage, to me, he's still Nicolas Cage. I don't have a big difference between this and him as Johnny Cage, Ghost Rider. I really don't. Oh. I mean, he's Nicolas Cage. I can appreciate part of it, but I'm also just, I don't know, he's distracting to me when he's on screen. I will say Chloe Grace Moretz is a freaking angel in this film. I know this isn't Hit Girl, but it might as well be. I'm surprised there wasn't a Hit Girl for a film. We may talk about that because God knows they wanted to, and they wanted to do a Hit Girl series, and they wanted to do more spinoffs that was supposed to be an animated series. They did do a Hit Girl maxi comic series, I want to say about 4 years ago now. Maybe it started 4 years ago. Each issue had a different writer. So I think based on this, she kind of kickstarted that as well. She is such a revelation in this film. It's over the top. It's fun. It's thoughtful on parts. And it also has the issue that some of both these directors, Matthew Vaughn and Edgar Wright, I think have a lot to say and sometimes just need someone else to rein them in a little bit. And I think they're very similar in that regard. But I think if you're into superhero movies, if you're into the violent type of games, movies, shows, without this, we don't get to The Boys on Prime, because that is a lot of what this is. It's kind of deconstructs what the superhero genre could be in a real world in an ultra-violent society. It's a good film. Watching it now for the third time, it's come down a little bit for me, but it's still solid. It's a 7. It's worth seeing. It does a good job. It has its place in the superhero films just by really breaking down what makes them work and what makes them just stupid at times. So 7 on 10, pretty damn good job at all involved.
Well, speaking of stupid, I'll put on my well actually glasses and say it's Johnny Blaze, not Johnny Cage.
You did say Johnny Cage. God damn it, Johnny Blaze.
Garrett,
whoops.
When you said, speaking of stupid, I thought you were going to say, let's go to Garrett for his rundown of the film. The few times I've watched this movie, I have had the exact same journey where I sit down to watch it and I'm thinking, I'm not really in the mood for this movie. I don't really want to watch it. And it starts going and I have all the dated references and the kind of sluggish way it gets us involved in this movie, in these characters, and the way it is just referencing past comic books. And by the way, I didn't even mention when we were talking about the movie, the one part of the voiceover that I really couldn't stand is when he goes, oh, you haven't seen American Beauty? Do you think I'm actually going to live through this? I think that's just obnoxious. And that's the one time where I'm looking at this movie, it's like, God, it's fucking obnoxious. However, as the movie goes on and it gets to the part where I mentioned where he gets his ass kicked and stabbed, from that point on, I'm invested. And by the time the movie's over, I just think to myself, God, I should watch this more often. It's a very curious journey to go through in a span of 2 hours. But Matthew Vaughn does a really good job of taking what didn't work in that comic, which was quite a lot, and making us care about these characters. And I know that is something I go to a lot. It's a reason why I don't like a lot of Scorsese's films, is the fact that I don't care about any of the characters. Here, I care about Kick-Ass. I care maybe more for Mindy, which may be a flaw of the actual film itself and maybe a flaw of the comic. But Mindy is so well defined, and that is part writing, that is part performance, and that is part Nicolas Cage. Because when we're seeing Big Daddy groom this girl, because that's what he's doing, he's grooming her, it could be looked at as, my God, what a terrible job of parenting. But he, in his own way, he is parenting her in a loving way. And I think the result of that is this character who comes out quite literally all guns blazing. Chloe Grace Moretz is remarkable in this. Aaron Taylor Johnson is very good. Nicolas Cage is good. But the thing that really works is the writing and the directing. I think the way the movie structured, I think the way that Vaughn has taken a Tarantino type approach and turned a comic book film into a violent yet very enjoyable 2 hours is really good. I will say, somebody mentioned in this podcast that it's a little over long. I agree with that. There are parts in the beginning that I would definitely trim. But at the same time, I have a similar journey where I am deeply invested. By that token, I have the same score written down as Adam. I have a 7. I think if it wasn't for that sluggish beginning, I would probably up it up at least a half point. But as it is, it's a very good experience, and I will probably watch this again in the next year or so. So 7 out of 10 for Kick-Ass from me.
You know, it's funny, before we get to Mattos, you mentioned Tarantino. I could totally see him wanting to adapt this himself.
Oh, totally.
Well, I'll be that guy. I thought this was a lot of fun going back to watch it, but for some reason, this movie to me is like a really good cheeseburger from Five Guys, where I enjoy it in the moment, but I know there's other burgers out there if I want something else. So I don't have that drive to ever go back and watch it, which is why I've only seen this like 4 times. There's something to be said about doing something against the grain, which both the comic, from my understanding, and this movie present. But I think a lot of what's here on a story level is pretty elementary. One, something either more subversive or much harsher on the whole about deconstructing superheroes. I'm not saying I want something like The Boys where it takes 4 seasons. To me, this concept still can be mined more in a 2-hour movie, because I also thought Super blew. I thought that sucked. So I don't think either of them got it 100% right, and I thought this was the superior of the two. But I also think, like I said, the Hit Girl, Big Daddy stuff to me is far more interesting and far harsher one of the hallmarks of a iconic character than the main character, who's fine, but I don't get that much of a read on him. I wouldn't read the continuing adventures of him if I was a reader. So maybe that's why I didn't clamor to go see the sequel either. But I landed on the same score as Adam. I'm going to give it a 7. I had a good time. It's a fun movie in the moment, but maybe I'm also desensitized because I've seen stuff on a violent level that makes this look like the Care Bears movie in certain ways. So what some people perceive this to be really audacious, I think it's just kind of, I guess by comparison, moot, but I'd still give it a recommendation. Well, you know who did endorse the next movie was one of its stars, which I guess was kind of a harbinger of things to come with how Kick-Ass 2 is received. Adam, you mentioned you haven't seen this, right?
Correct. I was, after I'd seen the first one and talking to somebody, I was like, oh my God, I really enjoyed that. And somebody told me, sweet, leave it alone. Just watch it. I took that to heart.
Yeah, and I was actually sent to review Kick-Ass 2 for a site I was working at the time. From what I remember, I still have only seen it the one time in theaters. From what I remember, it feels more like the comic book than this did. I know Matthew Vaughn steps away as director for the next film, and honestly, I don't have too many fond memories of it, but I only saw it that one time. So going back to it, I may feel differently. But everybody at this point is 3 years older. And when you have a precocious little girl like Chloe Grace Moretz was in this one, and you go 3 years later, you have some age to account for, and you have a lot of explaining to do as far as her relationship with Kick-Ass. And that's literally the one aspect, and Jim Carrey, that I remember from next week's film. And there aren't too many good memories.
Yeah, my recollection of this is not positive. It's not Mark Strong, if you want to recycle that one. But the one thing I remember is this might have the most nauseating vomit scene I've ever had to suffer through in a movie, to where I audibly gagged when I was in the theater. So when am I going to have that reaction again? We'll see.
When I was pulling clips for the intro and outro to this, that scene had come up, and you're absolutely right. It brought back those memories.
So is the next movie going to make us blow chunks, or are we actually going to find something to enjoy in Kick-Ass 2? Well, we'll see. But until next week, boys. So have you thought about what you want for your birthday? Can I get a podcast? Thanks, guys. I'm gonna be
risky. Life and soul at the party. I know what you're gonna say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just gonna tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts. Ooh, I'm living dangerous. What you did, I'll make you pay for it. See, I know that you're scared.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Exit. Words to live by.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Show's over, motherfuckers.
I am all set with my notes, so I am ready to go.
Okay, I have some kick-ass notes as well, so let me pull those up. Okay, I'm good.
Yeah, mine are just fine.
Leave all the work to us.
I knew that joke was coming at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least it's out of the way early.
Kick Ass, released on March 12th. I'm going to restart. Kick Ass, released March 26th. No, that's the UK release date. Fuck. All right. Kick Ass. There's three fucking release dates on Wikipedia. Just give me the one that matters. All right. Kick Ass, released April 16th. I first came to know Mark Millar when he wrote the Civil War comic, which we will talk about extensively in about 15 years because Marvel took the name with their Captain America Civil War and basically did something entirely different, just took the name. As they're going into the movie theater, Dave and his friends are leaving. They've gone to see The Spirit, or The Spirit 3, which... The first one wasn't even good enough to warrant a sequel, but this takes place in a world where that got three movies. So clearly that's a world where Frank Miller never existed.
I want to apologize to these characters just for going and seeing that movie.
Oh my God. I never did see the second one. I saw the first. I didn't even bother.
They only made a first. That's the joke.
No, they did a second. I thought they did a second one. No?
Of The Spirit.
No, they've done like four movies that look like The Spirit, but they aren't The Spirit.
Okay. I could have sworn
You're thinking of Sin City, because it's
that. Okay. Sin City, right. I probably am thinking Spirit. Yeah.
Basically anything Frank Miller has been involved with the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
but I'm so tired of hearing Joan Jett music in movies, and this is the most obvious song you can use. I mean, so much so that Shrek did this 10 years ago.
Joan Jett and Heart need to be banned from being used in films anymore, because you're right. They are both so overused. At this point, it wasn't, though. So it works for the scene in 2010. But in 2025, at this point, we've seen so many movies use this music, and I'm sure we'll see it more in this retrospective as we keep going.
The only one that was worse was when they used that No Doubt song in Captain Marvel.
I never saw Captain Marvel. So.
They used No Doubt just for a similar scene. And to be any more like blunt.
Mm-hmm.
I had a response. It rhymes with blunt, and it's used in this movie.
You're going to be fine, baby doll.